Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
If, like me, you've ever wondered what exactly the United Nations' remit is in our global fortunes, how much can it actually achieve in efforts to bring peace to our troubled planet, then you're going to find our next guest's insights most revealing. Major General Ian Gordon, AO, is a retired lifelong servant of the Australian Army and has worked for many years as a peacekeeper and a truce observer for the United Nations after serving for some time as our nation's Deputy Chief of Army. We commenced our conversation with Ian on the paradox that our armed forces are among some of the finest peacekeepers in the world.
The best peacekeepers are good war fighters because you come along with the skills, the training, the teamwork, the logistics to do a tough job of peacekeeping very well because of your preparation for warfighting. And that's one of the reasons I think Australians have been so good at peacekeeping. We've been involved in significant missions in Kashmir, Cyprus, the Middle East, Korea, Namibia, Iran, Iraq, Somalia, Cambodia,
wow,
the Persian Gulf, East Timor, the Sinai, Bougainville, in demining operations, and then more recently in the Solomon Islands. I think because we're seen to be professional, we're impartial, we're fair, and I'd like to use the word egalitarian. Now, our military is not without its faults. We're full of people and their individual foibles. But in my view, and you'd have to say that I was a little biased, but I think we're as good as the best in the world when it comes to peacekeeping.
Ian, the armed forces are full of acronyms. What was MINURSO and how were you involved?
Well, MINURSO is actually an acronym from a French phrase, which in English means a mission for the conduct of a referendum in the Western Sahara. Back in the early 90s, very early 90s, the United Nations wanted to intervene in a dispute in northwest Africa in a place called the Territory of the Western Sahara, which is just south of Morocco. The territory was claimed by Morocco. The indigenous people of the territory called the Sahrawi wanted their independence. They'd been fighting with Morocco over it for a long, long time. The UN brought the international community to the point where the Security Council decided that they should conduct a referendum to let the people decide, and they wanted the referendum supported by a peacekeeping mission. And that led to finally Australia sending a contingent, a signals unit, across to the Western Sahara.
Your next role was Deputy Commander for the UN's Transitional Authority in East Timor. From the outside, that looked like a tremendous success. Did it feel like it for you from the inside?
We did. In fact, I had the great honour of being there on the night of independence. When the United Nations flag was lowered and the East Timorese flag was raised, and the people got their country back. It was just a magnificent moment and a terrific year for me. These sorts of successes aren't as frequent as the United Nations would want. So if the question was, why was this one in particular successful, I saw a couple of things. The first was there was strong regional involvement. That is to say, most of the countries that were involved there in the UN group were countries who had a stake in the outcome. There was strong leadership. There was strong diplomacy, which means that where the East Timorese or the Indonesians might have been slipping back on their responsibilities, they were G'd up by the UN. There was a core of highly effective troop-contributing countries to the UN force in particular, and it was well-resourced.
Mm-hmm.
So it had everything going for it. East Timor still has its challenges, but it's an independent sovereign nation, and I think the UN can take a great deal of credit for that.
From East Timor, Ian, then to head of mission for the UN's Truce Supervision Organisation in Jerusalem, where ostensibly there doesn't seem to be much peace at all.
The Truce Supervision Organisation is what they call an unarmed observer mission. So it was actually, it's been going for a long, long time. It's one of the UN's very first peacekeeping missions. It started in 1948. after the war between Israel and its Arab neighbours. In fact, Israel declared independence, I think it was on the 15th of May 1948, and the next day the war started. The UN sent in a mediator to try to arrange a ceasefire between Israel and her Arab neighbours, and then a series of armistice agreements. And those armistice agreements between Israel and Lebanon and Israel and Syria, signed in 1949, are still in place. But I might add also that there are three other peacekeeping missions in the Middle East. And now, if this starts to sound complicated, then it absolutely is.
Yes.
There's a large peacekeeping force in southern Lebanon. There is a large, quite a large peacekeeping force on the Golan, where I had my people, and there is a peacekeeping force in the Sinai, where we had a few of our people. So you've got four of these peacekeeping missions, all in the one place. There are five host countries, no one's in charge of anybody.
Ian, the picture that you paint is something just shy of chaos. What's the idea behind the UN setting up so many different groups of people to oversee what seems to be the same outcome?
The answer is yes and no. I mean, the same outcome is a lasting and a just peace in the Middle East. But you have to break it up into the various components. Each time there is a conflict, the member states of the United Nations try to get together and work out what they can do about it, and it is often simpler to apply a new peacekeeping component to the latest conflict rather than redesign the whole thing. It's in some ways it's opportunistic, but in other ways it's reality. You just can't get in there and redesign the whole thing because the member states of the United Nations have moved on from the last one, and they have to deal with the next one.
Goodness.
Perhaps we could go back to this question at the moment now of if the United Nations has been there for 65 years.
Why don't we have peace?
Why don't we have peace, or why are we still paying for a peacekeeping mission if after 65 years it hasn't actually achieved anything?
You've taken the words right out of my mouth, Ian.
Well, that was one of the questions I was asked shortly after I arrived, is what are we still doing here?
Yeah.
I didn't immediately have an answer to it, but after 2 years, I realised what it was. There are two things, I think. Firstly, the UN's presence there is a break on excesses that either party to the conflict might take, because someone's going to watch them. So they have to deal with the consequences. The second thing that the peacekeepers do there is it's a form of communications. It's the international community saying to the parties to the dispute on the ground, this isn't it. This is not a reasonable, fair, equitable, just outcome. And we're not going to go away until you've achieved it. I think if the UN just left, then either party to the dispute could say, well, there you are. There's no case to answer. The situation as is what we deserve, and it's fair and it's right. And the other party that's complaining has no basis for their complaint. So even if there's only 153 unarmed military observers on the ground in the Middle East, they are sending, on behalf of the member states of the member states of the UN, a powerful message to the countries in the region saying, this is not right. We, the members of the UN, think it's not right, and we're going to stay here until it is right.
Ian, I understand that in deference to the peacekeepers currently serving in these conflict regions, you don't want to be seen to be an armchair general. But is there a key that we are yet to turn to find peace that, for whatever reason, we haven't?
There is a key, but nobody's in the position to turn it at the moment. I think the key is to treat the peoples on the ground with equally, to not discriminate, to deal with behaviour rather than deal with interests. Now, unfortunately, the members of the international community deal with the region according to their national interests, largely. That's the way nation states work. And I'm afraid that the interests of the member international community states tend to play out in the region, and therefore the inappropriate behaviour of certain groups in the Middle East doesn't get dealt with fairly.
And sadly, that doesn't appear to be something that the UN's going to be in a position to change, does it?
No. It's not. No, it's going to be... it's not the UN. Well, partly it's the UN, because that's the forum.
Yeah.
That is a legitimate, recognised forum with great mechanisms where interests and ideas can be brought together. But I might just comment on the UN briefly, because there is a lot of criticism about the UN.
Mm.
Some of it warranted, but my view is that the world has the UN that it wants. If the UN has shortcomings and inadequacies and limitations, that's the way the international community wants it. I think sometimes the UN takes criticism where it's the member states who should be taking the criticism. They've set up the UN that way. If it's under-resourced, it's because the member states don't resource it properly. If it's not given a mandate to do its job in a peacekeeping mission, that's the way the UN is set it up. So it shouldn't be... there's a lovely saying that it's not what the UN does, it's what the world does with the UN that's the important thing.
Ian Gordon, thank you so much for A, your service to the country, and then B, sharing your valuable time and insights into the United Nations and peace around the world. Have a terrific day.
It's my pleasure. Thanks very much, Dwayne.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.